Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I want to remind you on the way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. We are joined in studio by our new City Police Commissioner, Anthony Batts, joining us from the West Coast to the East. Welcome to Baltimore. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. I sincerely appreciate it.
And Greg Bernstein is with us, Baltimore City State's Attorney.
Mark, how are you?
I'm very well, Greg. Good to see you. And thank you both for joining us at the same time. I'm glad you did that for us and our listeners.
Well, I think it's, you know, indicative of the relationship that the commissioner and I have. I mean, it's new, of course. We're still trying to learn about each other. But I think the fact that we're both sitting here tonight should let your listeners know that the strong relationship that exists between the police department and the state's attorney's office is continuing.
So, my listeners, 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com and bring your thoughts to the airwaves. If I see you popping up on my screen, we will get you right on the air, 410-319-8888. So let's start there. It's not where I was going to start, but since you said that, Greg, I will start there. So then what is in store? What are the initiatives that you two have in mind historically? No matter who the state's attorney has been the last 20 years that I've been on the air and even before that, and no matter who the police commissioner has been, there has been enmity between the two branches of law enforcement in this town over lots of issues, over who does the charging, being able to talk with one another, having different agendas on how one should deal with issues of crime in Baltimore. So how is it any different now when you talk about it? You two obviously just met. So what does that mean?
Right. So we've just met, and obviously we're still, you know, working on initiatives and things to do. But what I would say is that at least what we're trying to do from the state's attorney's office perspective is to try to work with the officers and the detectives on the cases at the earliest possible stages. We've instituted a vertical prosecution model in the state's attorney's office where we bring our assistants into cases from the time of arrest or at the very when the offense is committed, for example, in a homicide, and when you're trying to develop a suspect and build a case. Whereas historically, there was more of a division, and the police would do their job, and when they finished, they would then bring it to the state's attorney's office. Well, we're trying to change that, and we have been changing that over the past year, where we're trying to help as much as we can, because we're not the investigators. That's the expertise that Commissioner Batts has with his folks. But to the extent that we can help them together build the case, that's a big difference. I think from the commissioner's standpoint, and I'll let him talk about this, he's very focused on the intelligence and the intel gathering piece. This is something that's very important to him, and that's going to be a big plus that we're trying to help him with. But he should talk about that.
Commissioners, let's start with, I mean, what is this new world that you two are trying to build?
Well, for me, it's not new, and I got to tell you, from my perspective, this is the third police department that I've been at. And where I come from, it's not the state's attorney, it's the district attorney, and I've had great relationships in the two prior cities that I've been in. And I got to tell you, with Greg, when he heard that I was the new commissioner or I was announced, I forgot what part of the world he was in, maybe Iceland or somewhere.
And, that was me.
He actually called, and he was saying, hey, I'm on vacation. I'm out here vacationing. And he set the tone there, and he was very open. We've had several opportunities to meet. He invited me to come over with his staff. He's been very open. I can't ask for a better partner in getting the job done. We're not always going to agree on everything. And my previous partners were dealing with the DAs instead of the state's attorneys, because we as police officers, we want everything that we do to get filed. I mean, we want to capture the bad guys. We want to get everything filed. That's not going to happen. And there's a check and balance to the system. It is supposed to be there for a good reason. And what's really nice about the framework here in the city of Baltimore is that you do have the state's attorneys there working with our investigators. So what that allows us to do is, as we're going forward, to be proactive. They're saying, you know, go a little to the right, go a little to the left. We need a little bit more along those lines. So I think that relationship is very good, and I think the model works well.
So, folks, many of you have had a lot of questions over the months about our police department, about crime fighting, about issues with police, issues with the state's attorney's office, both supportive and issues you have. So here's your chance, 410-319-8888. We'll bring your thoughts to the airwaves. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com. So let me ask. There's so many issues that have come up in the past, and let me just kind of throw some of them out here. Commissioner Bielefeld was a guest on the show many times.
Mm-hmm.
And many people kind of supported him as commissioner when mm-hmm. he was there. Let's take a sticky wicket to start with. There were a number of police shootings in the last year before you got here.
Mm-hmm.
And now since you've been here.
Mm-hmm.
And many people are asking questions about why there have been no indictments of police officers, or why the cases have been unresolved and still being investigated after a year with certain shootings, with the that deaths at the hands of police officers have not gone to the grand jury. Many people in the city are wondering why.
Well, I mean, let's try to break that down. Mark, your date is a little off in terms of the state's attorney's office not charging police officers. In fact, we have charged, unfortunately, we've had to, but we've charged a number of police officers in cases in which they've either committed assaults on citizens or they've put false information in affidavits, things of that nature. So the notion, that we don't go forward on cases is just simply not right. Certainly there have been a couple of cases where there have been police-involved shootings, but in fact there are really very few, if any. I can think of one where the investigation has been getting close to a year. It's still not a year, but close. But a couple others are just a few months old. And I think that we take our role as prosecutors very seriously. We thoroughly investigate these cases with the help of the Commissioner's Internal Investigations Division. We work hand in glove, so to speak, in terms of investigating these cases. And, every case is different. And in terms of how long it takes to complete the investigation, how long it takes to make the final decision. And I can assure you and your listeners that we're working as diligently as we can to reach a conclusion.
I mean, the reason I asked that question is that then I want to go to the phones here, and Clarence, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call. Is that let's take the case of Anthony Anderson, who was 46 years old from East Baltimore.
Right. Okay, so with Mr. Anderson, well, let me talk about that. That case, very tragic, an unfortunate death. But that happened on September 21st. That wasn't a year ago. That was only just a few months ago.
But if one citizen shot and or killed another citizen in this city, it doesn't take months for the most part to find the person who did it or to even address the case, right?
And Mark, I'd have to disagree with you about that.
Why?
Joe, because as I said before, every case is different. There are some cases where there's a homicide that occurs where one citizen shoots another citizen, and because of the investigative work from the commissioner's office and his homicide detectives, they're able to quickly solve the case, and thanks to the good work that they do, we're able to make an arrest within 24, 48 hours. There are other cases that take 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. There are other cases that take even longer. So I guess my point is that it's difficult to say because, for example, in the case involving Mr. Anderson, it happened 4 months ago, that somehow that is too long a period of time to make a final decision. What I can tell you is these cases are complicated. Whenever you have police officers involved, you have multiple issues, of course, because they're, in effect, performing their duties, performing their job. You have to make decisions about whether they've gone outside the norm of what's appropriate behavior as a police officer, or is it a reasonable use of force. It's not simply a case of a robbery gone bad or someone trying to settle a score. These are very complicated issues that we have to decide and we have to investigate. We have to get the evidence to prove them.
So, Commissioner, let me ask you this question. And if I'm correct, this was not under your watch.
It was just before my watch, actually.
It
happened, I believe, on a Friday night, and I landed on the airplane on Sunday. So as I landed, this issue was there. I actually met with Miss Edith, his mother, that week, I think probably on Wednesday. On Tuesday, I met with the two officers. As I met with the officers, I shared with them that I had no intentions of throwing them under the bus. However, we were going to investigate this very thoroughly, and we're going to make sure that we do it correctly. And I told them, I said, if you do a good job, I will defend you and support you in what you do. If you make a mistake out there, then we will hold you accountable for that mistake. I went to Miss Edith, and I met with the family. I met with his mom, his dad, his brother, his sister, and his kids. And I took my command staff out there who were very uncomfortable about the situation. Yeah. But what I want my organization to understand is that I expect them to have a reverence for life, for all life. And I share with the mother that we will do an investigation and we would do it correctly. And I share with her that I met with the officers too. And so we would do a balanced investigation and we won't jump to conclusions. And I think what Greg is saying is that we're taking the appropriate time to investigate and find the facts and the information and to go forth. And I think that's reasonable on both sides. And Miss Edith and the family, although they were traumatized and upset, as you can understand, you know, they lost a son, they lost a father, they lost a brother. But at the same time, what they want to know is that the process has been done fairly, has been done ethically, and it's been done professionally. And the police officers want the same thing. And if a mistake happened out there, then that comes clear. If there was misconduct done out there, then we will hold them accountable.
So in on the way to the phones here, so what, in a case like that, does the police officer remain on duty or are they put on desk work? What happens to the police officer?
In that particular situation, the officers are what we call suspended, and that's an administrative motion where we bring them down, we take their guns, we take their badges, we take their ID, and they're relieved of any police power and enforcement power. They are at work. They were off for a period of time, but they came back. They are at work, and they're working inside. They do not have the ability at this time to go outside. They're not doing investigations. They're not doing surveillances. I got in a call to my office probably about a week or two ago from Miss Edith, who said that I believe I saw those officers in my area, and they're doing police work in the area. And we immediately looked into that, and that wasn't the case, that they were still on suspension. They're still inside, and we're waiting for the adjudication of the case and my internal affairs investigators to finish their investigation.
And to that point, Mark, let me just follow up with what the commissioner said. I mean, and you heard his response. It is not in Commissioner Batts's best self-interest or best interest or the police department's best interest for the case or the investigation to be prolonged, because if an ultimate decision is made not to proceed, for example, he needs to get those guys back on the street. Or if a decision is made to charge, then he's got to take appropriate action. It's not helping him for the case to linger any longer than it needs to be.
So who does the investigation? Your office?
We do it together. We do it together, and the Internal Investigation Division, or when there's a death that's resulting, the Homicide Division of the Police Department works with folks in my office. We work together to interview the witnesses, to develop the forensic evidence, to build the case, and make a determination about what should happen.
Let me open the phones. 410-319-8888. You just heard Greg Bernstein, our state's attorney, who's with us here in the studio, along with our new police commissioner, Anthony Batts. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Commissioner Batts, good afternoon to you. And
hello, sir.
Mr. State's attorney, I'd like to ask you, Commissioner, to do a personal favor for myself and some of the citizens in Baltimore, and that would be to specifically look into the conditions on the outside of some of our seniors' buildings.
Yes, sir.
There are several senior buildings in this high-rise in the city that every police officer that works in Baltimore City should be able to tell you where they are, that what goes on the outside of those seniors, and I place emphasis on senior buildings, should not be occurring. If you could pay personal attention to that, you know, make that a priority of some sort, I would appreciate it very much.
Let me just get a clarification on what you're asking me. When you're saying a senior building, are you saying an older building or a building for senior citizens?
I think he's saying building where senior citizens are in public, the senior citizen housing.
Got it. All righty. We are taking that note, and we will follow up on it, sir.
There always have been issues in senior buildings because a lot of the buildings are, because the definition of disabled is so wide, a lot of people who are recovering addicts and others who are in the buildings, and there have been huge issues over the years.
Well, not just the ingress, but the egress. You know, in many urban environments, including here in Baltimore, there are seniors who are shut in and who are afraid to go out on the streets. And that's unacceptable. And I think we have to focus on our seniors because they have special needs and special wants. And in communities, it's really, really incumbent upon us that seniors have the ability to walk across the street to their store without being accosted, without being harassed, without being robbed. And that's a focus for us, and that's something we will be paying attention to.
So there's some questions, I think, that we wrestled with during Commissioner Bielefeld's time. When we talked about getting officers out of the cars and on the beat, it seemed to be very difficult to get that done.
Well, it's kind of interesting on that. We just have been pushing very diligently to get officers out. I've spent my first 3 or 4 months leading the way with that. When we had a spike in violence that took place in November going into December, we moved the detectives down to the streets. And so we had every piece of this organization, no matter whether they were in academy, whether they worked in an office behind a desk, everybody was out on the street. But I expected everyone to be out there, including myself. And so we were out there in that 35-degree weather. We were walking out there with the officers. We were ensuring that we were leading from example. But I think officers are starting to see, and I think we – I don't know if the citizens and residents understand what good officers they do have. You hear a number of stories, and the guys get banged, and they don't get thanked enough. But I can tell you, you have a lot of diligent officers out here who care a lot. And the thing is that I am amazed of how many of them are born in Baltimore. Now, we have an issue of them staying in Baltimore, but there's a large number of them born and raised in Baltimore with a great deal of pride. And what I found out is not only are you born in Baltimore, it's what high school you've gone to. So they take a stake in loving this city. And we're pushing them to get out of the cars, to make contact. And the critical piece on that is making contact with residents and citizens and listening and hearing how they expect us to police their communities.
I mean, one of the things that and I hear what you're saying, and I think that there's a lot of people in the city who think there's a huge disconnect between a sizable number of police officers and the people in this community.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
That authority, that authority is can go to the head of police officers.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced it. Mm-hmm. Many people experience it in the city, where citizens are addressed in a very impolitely.
Mm-hmm.
That everybody is kind of treated as if you're a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a citizen?
I'll be pretty frank with you. As I've met with every politician within the city, even the council people, president of the council, the mayor, congress people that are from this area, have made mention of how we interact with our community, which is unacceptable. Some of the things that you just said, they said that they agree. And so we're going to take upon a campaign. And you've seen in the newspaper that we're starting a new community policing philosophy, and not just a program, but a philosophy within our organization. And, you know, it's the funny thing. Every time I mention it to some people, they go, you want to engage the community? Nice try. Well, I think it's a very doable. I think when we get across to all the employees in our department that we're here to serve, those people that I'm going to hire in the future are going to be those who are here to serve the community. We don't tell the community what to do. We don't act unprofessional with the community. They are the ones who pay our salaries. And I'm not saying that because I'm on a radio. I'm not saying that as a cliche. That is something that I have believed in for 30 years, and I will push that in this organization during the tenure that I'm here.
So let me open the phones here. A number of people calling in and writing in, and let's get those questions out. Then we'll come back to my questions, 410-319-8888. And Stephen and Waverly, you're on the air.
Yes. I don't know if this question has been asked. I just got off of work, and I've seen an email that both Commissioner Bernstein and Betts be on the radio, and I'm with the Baltimore People's Assembly, and we've been organizing around the case around Anthony Anderson, and we have been informed that the officers who had killed Anthony Anderson, or I should say murdered Anthony Anderson, which the coroner ruled that it was a homicide, why are those officers still on the job being paid, and when will the community expect some justice and no charges out of 14 civilians who have been shot, majority of them unarmed? Not one officer has been charged, has been convicted. And I want to know why that every time that somebody gets shot, you have your spokesperson get up and give some flowery speech about, you know, defending the police or whatever. But why? I mean, 14 shots, 14 and not one officer has done wrong. Everyone knows that. I mean, please. I mean, you think the community is a fool or something?
All right. So it was raised earlier, but we can talk about it in a large sense. I think what was said earlier was the investigation is ongoing about Anthony Anderson. The officers are off the street, badges gone, guns taken away. And so that's a direct question I should ask about that. And then you can answer the larger question about how about the other 14 or the 13 he's talking about. When will this happen? Are we talking about telling the citizens of Baltimore and his family to wait 3 months, 6 months, a year?
When what will happen?
when we will know whether these police officers will be indicted or found that they did not commit murder.
You're talking about the Anderson case.
Or any of the other cases.
Right.
Well, let's talk about Anderson. That's what he was asking about.
Right. So, as I said before, that investigation is continuing.
But
and that we are working with all due, pace. And as I said before, there's really no reason for us to delay. And once the investigation is completed and we've concluded our review of the evidence, we'll make a determination as to whether what should happen.
So, I guess the question of the people like Stephen calling in, then we'll go to the next caller, is that is when all these kind of police-involved shootings and killings are taking place, people don't see any action. People don't see a response. They hear, we're investigating. We're going to look into it. We're going to have a decision made. And then it's 3 months, it's 4 months, it's 5 months. So people are justifiably asking the question, why does it take so long answer the question, one way or the other?
Right. So again, Mark, as I said before, I would disagree with your premise that that the cases take, an inordinate amount of time or that they drag on. Each case is different. And we investigate those cases with all due, not haste, but because we don't want to make a hasty decision. But we review them, we make a determination, and we move on from there. And the same applies with respect to the Anderson case. It's really no different. And look, let me be clear. I am certainly not tone deaf, and I'm certainly not naive to the fact that with respect to this particular case involving Mr. Anthony Anderson and his tragic demise, that it's something that the public is looking at carefully and that they would like a decision one way or the other. About what's going to happen. I am very sensitive to that. But as the commissioner said earlier, it is not fair to the family of the victim, it's not fair to the officers, and it's not fair to the public for us to act precipitously and make a decision without doing a full investigation.
So let me ask this other question about that. I really want to get into other subjects that we have to address here in the next half an hour we have left, and all these callers are calling in. But I know when you came in as commissioner here in Baltimore, probably one of the first things you did was to take the stack of reports to look at these police-involved shootings and what occurred. Because you have to respond to them, because under your watch, they're going to be resolved or not resolved.
Yes, sir.
So when you look at the numbers that happened,
mm-hmm.
are the numbers beyond what you think are acceptable? Are they within acceptable limits? What is an acceptable limit?
Well, I don't put a number what is acceptable. It's on an individual case-by-case basis. You have to look at the circumstances. You got to look at the totality. When I look at it, and I said this earlier, I expect officers, and I've told this to my executive command staff, I expect our officers to show and act in the process of having a reverence for life, which means when we pulled up to that call, did we do all the proper things to make sure not only did the officers go home that night, but the residents or the citizens that we came in contact, if they went home that night? So did we use the correct tactics? Now, the caller before was obviously upset, and he was very passionate about what he says, and he should be. We carry guns. We have the legal right to use those guns, and we should be checked on that. We should have questions asked of us, and we should answer those questions because we have a tremendous amount of power and authority. What I will do is that I'm bringing into the organization a gentleman who deals in officer-involved shootings who has an expertise. I'm trying to bring in consultants to look at how we do our training to make sure that our training is that of where we don't put ourselves in a position that we have to fire our guns to use deadly force, and to make sure that when those cases that are already done, that we evaluate those in a proper way. And I will look for a way to get back to the community without violating police officers' rights, because we have the Maryland Police Officer Bill of Rights, which give officers the rights to protect themselves. And at the same time, not to put their names out there or embarrass them or give other information. So I have to find the balance of the public trust, which is a big deal to me. When this gentleman calls in and says, we want to know what's going on, we work for this community, and the community has to have trust in us to know that we're a strong, ethical police organization and that we do things in a professional way. So I will sit down with my organization as we go on to find out ways on how we can bring information and better data to our community.
So we have a lot of subjects to deal with here. So what we're going to do is take a very short break and come back. We have to do that here in a second. We're going to go to our first caller. There's Hank and Stacy and Aaron and Bruce. We're going to get to all of your calls. Major Neil Franklin, retired police officer, has written in. We're going to read his question in the air, and then we have a question about gangs in Baltimore we're going to get to as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back with our state's attorney and our police commissioner. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I am here this hour with our new police commissioner, Anthony Batts, and our state's attorney, Greg Bernstein, 410-319-8888. Right to the phones, as I promised. Got to get the mics up.
I'm just wondering when it is that we stop saying new in front of police commissioner.
Another couple months?
No, I like new. Keep saying new. You know?
It's been, what, 4 months? Five months.
Yeah, it's going on 4 months.
But who's counting?
Four months. 410-319-8888. I'm saying new because this is the first time he's been on the show.
All right. Okay. That's
after
fair.
This, I won't call him new when he comes.
No, fair. Mark, call me new.
410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
How are you doing today, Mr. Steiner?
Very well, Hank. Welcome.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Hello?
Hank, we got you. You're on the air.
Mr. Steiner?
We're having problems with the phones again.
Hello? Can you hear me?
We can.
All right, I had to turn my radio up a little bit to make sure that y'all can hear me.
No, turn your radio down. That's why you can't hear.
I'd like to give a special thanks to Officer Love, who arrested me. I was detained last night. Me forgetting being absent-minded, forgot to pay my seatbelt ticket. Now, you know, I got a great demise against the police department, right? But I have to say that they are not all bad, right? Because yesterday I had one of the more finer experiences with Baltimore City's police department, right? And Officer Love and the other officer, which I really can't read his name because y'all copiers don't print on the third and fourth sheet. Y'all need to fix that so we can see what we're doing, right? Because that's how you miss certain things, right? But I like to say all officers are bad, and I like to thank them for that. And second of all, the commissioner, I would like to give him a chance to show me his best. On the other hand, Mr. Bernstein is the one who's responsible for bringing anybody who does anything to charge, right? Not the commissioner. The commissioner is only responsible for investigating and making sure that it's due diligence, right? Mr. Bernstein, what are you going to do? Because you, sir, are letting these people, you are letting these bad officers kill my children. I hold you responsible since you took Ms. Jessamy's spot.
Mr. Bernstein?
Hank, you're right. I did take Ms. Jessamy's spot. And as I've been saying, since I came on the show earlier, it is my responsibility to make the charging decisions. And we thoroughly investigate cases as they come in. We work with the police department in a collaborative way, and we decide who should be prosecuted.
So, I don't know, Hank was just saying he was arrested last night because he didn't pay his fine for
seatbelt, I think is what he said.
I think that's what he said.
Seatbelt. So, let me push this to Tevin, since Hank is gone. But, I mean, is that the kind of thing we should be arresting people for? If you pull somebody over and they have an unpaid fine for not wearing a seatbelt and they're driving, arrest them? Is that our response to be that?
Well, it's not the biggest thing that's on our plate. However, if it's a warrant or a direction from the court that you will, upon coming upon this person, take them into custody because they have failed to comply with the law, then you have to do that also. And I don't know if that's the case. However, the bigger issue that I think he was trying to address is the fact that, again, like your previous caller, that he's looking for the government to be fair and to share information with him. And I think Mr. Bernstein and I are both saying the same things, is that we're moving in that direction in every way that we possibly can to make sure that we have a fair process to all parties that are involved. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, I've put medals around officers' necks who have been involved in heroic deeds, dealing with shootings in very dangerous situations. I've been at the bedside and prayed for officers as they fought for their lives who have been shot in beds in hospitals. I've given flags at grave sites that officers have been killed. But at the same time, I've also arrested officers or had in charge and terminated officers who have done misconduct at the same time. Just because you have officer-involved shootings out there doesn't mean that they're all bad. And certainly, like the caller said, not all officers are bad. And a lot of officers are extremely good, and they want to do things out of the goodness of their heart. But there are too many guns on the streets of Baltimore. And these are the police officers who have to come in contact with people carrying guns, who have our murder rate up, less than 10 years ago, had a murder rate up to 350 human lives that were being lost, that were being taken. And these officers have to come in contact with these guys.
Let me go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. Stacy, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you,
Very
gentlemen?
Well. Welcome, Stacy.
Thank you for taking my call, Mark. I just wanted to say you both seem extremely well-versed in the trials and challenges of urban environments, but I don't know if you're both, with all due respect, as knowledgeable about Baltimore specifically. Like, your answers, they're great answers, but they could be applied to anywhere urban USA, not necessarily specifically Baltimore. You're going to need major comprehensive programs to be able to rebuild the trust between both of your departments and the community. The people that actually live within Baltimore, like Baltimore City urban areas, they aren't treated like they're citizens, just like Mark was saying earlier. They're treated just like they're criminals already. So it's like guilty until proven innocent. Like, just because they're poor, they're criminals. And it's just, you really need, like I said, you're going to have a major comprehensive plan and program to be able to introduce something different into the community that they'll trust and they'll believe. And it's going to be more than just an officer standing outside. That may be even more menacing. You're going to have to do something that creates some sort of real conversation.
Stacy, are you willing to
and
help?
And if you'd like, I can give my information to you. I can help you with that.
Good. Stacy, so I just asked, this is Tony Batts. Stacy, I just asked the question, if are you willing to help? The reality for me, Stacy, is I grew up as a kid in a very dysfunctional neighborhood and community. I grew up in very tough environments. No, I didn't grow up in Baltimore. I have policed areas that were extremely tough and have taken a lot of privilege, a lot of pride in policing areas that have very troubled environments. And coming back to the East Coast is coming back to where my family is. I have family that are here in Baltimore. I have family that have been arrested. I have family who are addicted to heroin from this area. So, no, I may not know everything about Baltimore, but what I do know is that I grew up in a lot of the same ways that young kids are here. I want to make an impact. I want to make a difference. I give a darn, and I want to work with the community. And I don't think it's not as sophisticated or complicated as you say. I think it comes down to basics, and that you treat people with respect, period, bottom line. And we start from that point of view.
Instead of what Stacey was saying, then we'll go right back to the phones here. We've talked a lot on this program about, and I've talked with Commissioner Bielfeld about, and other people as well, the issue of institutional racism inside things like police departments. And I'm not talking about every officer is a racist. I'm talking about, doesn't have the officers black, white, Latino, or Asian. It's the institutional mindset of who is an enemy, who is a suspect, who you go after, and why. And every department in America has to deal with that. So the question is, how do you deal with that? How do you address that? That's part of the things that Stacey was just saying. That's part of the mistrust.
I think there is beyond just that, what Stacey was saying as mistrust. And I think there's things that we're going to have to do. But if you're talking about bias within a police department, every human being that walks this face on earth, including you and Greg Bernstein and myself, all have biases. We come that way. We see things a certain way in the world. What I have to do internally in this organization is make sure that employees are treated with respect and that biases do not impact employees within the organization, that women, that men of all color all have the opportunity to elevate within the organization. So the organization looks like the community in which it polices, first of all. And that doesn't mean that bias is removed. And beyond that, when we come in contact with our community and our residents, that our actions, and they have to be reviewed and held to a high standard, that our actions are not seen as showing bias of any kind, whether it's ethnic bias or gender bias or any other type of bias as we do policing. And that comes also with ensuring that we do a high level of training.
part of the training that I have coming in here over the next, I believe in February or March, is impartial policing. And we have specialists that we're bringing in from Washington, D.C., who have trained police departments nationally, that we're going to put on a program that every employee, whether sworn or professional staff, will go through this training to understand that you do have bias, but how you implement your policing and your professional standards will be without bias in the city.
Well, I'm going to push a little tad further, but I promise to get back to the phone. I think the issue of institutional discrimination and racism is not a question of individuals. It's a question of who is seen as the potential enemy. Who is seen as the person you have to be wary of? Who is the person you have to go after? And whether you're a black, like, one of the, in terms of a citizen abuse, one of the departments that has the worst records is Prince George's County. And that is a department made up of 48% black officers. So it's not a question of being white or black.
Exactly.
It's a question about the institution and who you go after, who you target, who you do respect or don't respect, and who you suspect before you even know who they are.
Your actions. Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, I want to try to stay focused on Stacey's question because I think that she's right that we do have to kind of think about Baltimore. And, I mean, I grew up in Baltimore. And I think that Stacey is right that we have a long way to go. I think the genesis of this goes back about 15 or 20 years ago when the city and the police department adopted a zero tolerance policy, brought down the policies that were being implemented in New York to see if they would work. And the notion of a zero tolerance policy or broken windows policy, however you want to frame it, is that if you aggressively prosecute the small quality of life type offenses, that in turn will result in a reduction in more serious crime and make neighborhoods safer. Well, frankly, it didn't work in Baltimore. It just didn't work. And more importantly, what happened was that you built up a tremendous amount of mistrust between the police department and the citizens of Baltimore City, because you had time and time again citizens or fathers watching, their sons getting, thrown on the ground and arrested on a street corner or vice versa. And that kind of mistrust built up. And we're now kind of paying the piper for that, so to speak, in terms of getting witnesses to come forward and witness intimidation and having witnesses come in and testify and things of that nature. So we have a job to do in trying to rebuild that trust. Now, one of the things we're doing in the state's attorney's office is about a year ago we implemented a community prosecution model where we've totally redesigned our office now. And instead of having the historical felony divisions or narcotics divisions, now you're a zone prosecutor. We divided the city into three zones.
Right.
We matched it up. I'm sure you've heard about it with the police districts.
You talked about it on the show last
time. And it gets us much more connected to the community. So that's some of the things that we're doing. And plus, you've already heard from the commissioner in just a few minutes all of the things that, he wants to try to do, which are very exciting and I think are going to go a long way to improving those relationships.
So I have – make a call in here. I want to read this email, and I have a question here about gangs. So let's make it through these things if we can get through the next 14 minutes here. 410-319-8888. Brenda in Northeast Baltimore. You're
yes,
on the air.
Good evening, Mark. I'm glad you have the commissioner and the state's attorney on there because I would like to know from the commissioner can the officers pull a vehicle over and with the excuse it's a taillight, that's the reason, and then they search the male's car without a search warrant? And they have did that to several young black males. Is that legal?
Well, not knowing the complete circumstances.
Hello?
Can you hear me, ma'am?
Brenda, can you hear us?
Hello?
Oh, I love this phone system. It works so well. Brenda, can you hear us?
Well, just go answering the question, I'll put it this way, because it's very difficult without knowing all the circumstances of what takes place. An officer has a right to stop when a vehicle has some type of vehicle mechanism that's out. It could be a turning light. It could be a violation in registration. It can be an array of different things. The officer has a right, in fact, to do that. And here in the city of Baltimore, which is even greater, we have a very high pedestrian fatality rate as well as car accident rate, and I can assure you, as I registered my car to get insurance, and it tells you how hard the rates are here. But more importantly, if you feel that you've been mistreated, if you feel that your car has been searched for some reason that may be from the state of racial profiling, which is really what I think the conversation, the subtext of what the caller is,
is that you make that complaint to our internal affairs unit. And one of the things is that I have Graylin Williams, who is my chief in charge of internal affairs. We take those very seriously. I take it very seriously. We will go back and review. And if the officer is involved in misconduct, not only hold him or her accountable, but also tell you if, in fact, that the officer has a right to have that action, we'll get back to you and let you know that.
But can a police officer search a car without a warrant if someone just has a taillight out?
Well, if you you can have a what if that goes a long way. You just can't answer that. I give you an example. If I see a guy who's making an illegal turn and I stop he or she for an illegal turn, and I go up to the car, and as I go up to the car, I see him doing furtive movements under the seat. I see something that looks perhaps like a gun handle, or if, in fact, I go there, and when he opens the windows, big fumes of marijuana and different things come out. Now, if there's something that I can see in plain view, if there's something that leads me to believe that they're in the middle of a crime, or if, in fact, I had gotten an earlier call that the same car fitting this description, it was part of a robbery, I can follow up to see if, in fact, I can take that gentleman or person out of the car to further that investigation. But if it's just for a traffic light and there's nothing else to it, then what the officer should be doing is giving a citation, that's all. So, and her follow-up to that, or the follow-up to the young African-American males, is to file that complaint. What I don't say is to challenge that officer at that scene about that situation. And the same thing I tell my young sons, who are African-American males, is if you're stopped at any given point in time, and I tell anybody this, is that you, if you think that you're wronged, you take down the officer's names, and you don't try to challenge at that scene. You have internal affairs and processes that we can go to investigate that.
Let me read this email and then come back to the phones here. This is an email from Neil Franklin, and his question is, in light of where we're moving as a country with marijuana reform, decriminalization in places like Colorado and Washington, why will you not consider decriminalization of marijuana possession in Baltimore? If you do, here are some very possible results. A significant reduction in the nonviolent drug case load for police, central booking, juvenile booking in the courts. This equates to a significant cost savings, which could be diverted to after-school activity and other learning centers. It means less black Baltimoreans saddled with drug arrests. It means fewer inappropriate stop-and-frisk encounters by police, resulting in fewer Fourth Amendment violations. It also means a better opportunity for police to improve their relationship with the community, many young blacks. So why not? Maybe the extra police and court time could be redirected towards domestic violence, rape investigations, and crimes against our children. So I know you guys don't make the law, but there are increasingly people around the country who are taking positions on how we might reform the system, so we're not making these kind of arrests. Thoughts?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think the laws that were passed in Colorado and the state of Washington are great, and here's why. Because they will give us here in Baltimore a great opportunity to study their impact. Because it is somewhat uncharted waters in the sense that we've never legalized any kind of drugs before. So I think what will be helpful is to see if, in fact, those kinds of things that were discussed before, in fact, happen, and seeing, you know, how it works in those states. The other thing I would say is that here, at least in Baltimore City, we have in the state's attorney's office, we have a diversion program, an early resolution court for anyone who's arrested for small amounts of marijuana to keep them from getting any kind of criminal record, because we all know how much that saddles people in terms of job opportunities, educational opportunities. So to the extent that we can, you know, maneuver those people into those programs and keep them from getting records, we're all in favor of that, and we do that very aggressively. We also, last year, were successful in passing legislation that substantially reduced the penalty for possession of small amounts of marijuana to keep the cases in district court where they belong and not bounced up to felony court. That's having a real impact as well. It's important to remember, and the commissioner well knows this, that oftentimes very serious criminals, violent repeat offenders who we are monitoring very closely, which the commissioner and I could have a whole nother show about if you wanted to hear about what we're doing to try to attack the violent crime problem in this city. But oftentimes those are the individuals who are getting arrested for small amounts of marijuana, and that can have a very measurable impact on violent crime in the city to the extent that those folks get arrested. So the point is, it is a very complicated issue. It requires some further study. We'll see what happens in the other jurisdictions.
So to that end, when there was a spike in crimes, one of the things that you were recorded as saying was that the spike of violence in Baltimore, in part, was the youth off for the black ruler family and gangs in Baltimore City. So some people are wondering, is that a way to do the kind of injunctions, gang injunctions you wanted to do in Oakland to happen here? And B, there are a lot of people who think that the gang structure is not that deep in Baltimore, and that we're looking at many more street corner and smaller local operations than the BGF. So,
One of the things that was really kind of interesting to me, and it goes back to the question, do you need to be from Baltimore to understand Baltimore and understand communities that want to be policed in a professional and fair manner, is that every gang that I have researched here by being in the position as commissioner started in California. For the last 32 years, I've been chasing these same gangs with the same names. You have Treetop Piru. Treetop Piru came from Compton, California, north of Long Beach. You have several subsets of Crips that are here. You have BGF. BGF started, Black Guerrilla Family started in the prisons of California. So all of these gangs that we have here are subsets of things that I've been dealing with and chasing for 30 years. I think in some neighborhoods we have, and it depends on how you define gangs. For me, is if you have a criminal enterprise with more than three people together coming together for the process of doing crime, that's a gang. You can call it NFL, which is named after a particular area in the community. You can call it, I think it's Poplar Grove Crips, which are named after a street. They're gangs. They're organized groups that are going out doing robberies. They're organized groups who are selling drugs. They're organized groups who are coming together to further themselves. We have an issue in Baltimore. And when I came, one of the things is I started talking about Black Guerrilla Family and Treetop Piru having conflict that was going back and forth. The reason I was talking about that is because we started seeing a spike in violence, and the media was reporting that we were having this outrageous amount of violence that was taking place throughout the city. And really, it's not. Usually in most cities, 10% of your population is usually responsible for anywhere from 60 to 70% of your violence. And so what you're having here with Black Guerrilla Family, which is pervasive in some areas throughout our community, is their ability to try to take over this city. They are taking on small groups like the Piru sets and the Crips sets, and they're taxing them and forcing them to pay 20%. If they do not pay 20%, they're then shooting and killing them, and that's what's taking place in some parts of the city. But that violence is not one that is pervasive throughout the entire city of Baltimore. And in honest truth is that there's very small areas or concentrated areas in Baltimore where you have that type of violence, and people need to know that. Because when you come to the harbor, when you come to many of our neighborhoods, you don't have that impact. However, in the neighborhoods that we do have those impacts, that's where we need to do a lot of work with our community to let them know that we're there to serve them too, and that gangs will not rule the day in those communities, in those neighborhoods.
And we're going to come back and request that everybody come back here sometime in the next couple of months to do an entire hour just on violence in the city, maybe a special town meeting to talk about how we're going to address that. But let's get another call in here before the end of the hour. Aaron in East Baltimore, you're on the air. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air, Aaron.
Hello?
Aaron, you're on the air.
Hello?
Aaron, you're on the air.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you. You're on the air. We have 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, well, Commissioner Batts, I have a problem. You talk about community and police working together. However, in my community, a young lady was murdered, aided and abetted by one of your officers, Monet Turnage, is the young lady's name. How do you expect to create trust within our community when we've had that kind of an incident happen and we seem to not have heard anything that's happened as a result of that?
Sir, I have to apologize because I don't know the background of that particular case, but what I can do, and Greg Bernstein is raising his hand, he'll talk to that, but what I can tell you is if we have any police officers who are involved in criminal conduct, police officers who are involved in misconduct, they will be held accountable. We will find a way to report out to the community that we are holding those standards. I think you have a responsibility to keep us in check. I think you have a responsibility to ask us tough questions. And we have a responsibility to respond back to you and let you know that we are doing the right things. At the same time, when you have police officers who are doing a very good job, police officers that are going far and beyond, which you have a number. I want to get that information out also. And I don't think the community gets that a lot. You get the negative stories, and you don't so much get the positive stories where officers take money out of their pockets. Officers help buy bicycles. Officers do a number of different things for this community that they don't have to, but they do.
So we only have like a minute to break here. Did you want to say something very quickly, Gray?
Well, I did want to make sure everyone understood that that was a case that our office fully investigated, and we determined that the officer did not, that there was insufficient evidence to charge him with aiding and abetting the death of the poor young child. And that he was not involved in that or involved in a cover-up. So that was a full investigation. We did, of course, charge someone. We charged the mother of one of the young boys who or girls, I forget which now, who was involved in the death of that child with obstruction. But the officer was found not to have been involved.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being here. I look forward to coming back and
absolutely
having conversations.
If the commissioner comes back, I'll come back.
Good.
Me too.
That's great. We'll have you both back. Commissioner Tony Batts, Anthony Batts.
Tony, please.
Tony Batts, our Baltimore City Police Commissioner, almost not new. And Greg Bernstein, who's not new.
Baltimore you City call State him attorney. Old?
I'm not going there. Good to have you both with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening and joining us today for this conversation we've had in the air. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Maronis. Our engineer is Andrew Holt. We want to welcome our new interns, Matthew Hamburger and Lila Warshaw. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and hear new interviews as well as information about our guests and our work, please visit our website at steinershow.org. And for public radio, for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.